The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. Our first article was published on June 22 and is entitled, After a Decade of Sex Abuse Education in Africa, Freely in Hope Pivots to American Churches, by Fiona Andre. Jean Nangwala started singing in her local church worship team at a very young age. She considered this assembly, founded by her grandfather and located in the south of Zambia, a safe haven. Standing on the stage to sing every Sunday, she said, was her greatest joy, until a member of the worship group, a church leader she trusted, sexually assaulted her when she was 19. When Nangwala opened up about the rape, pastors questioned her story and blamed her. Ultimately, Nangwala said she stopped singing, left the church, and never returned. I was left alone to find safety in a world that does not involve church, when I've always loved church, she said. Today, she shares her stories in churches to educate members and leaders as part of Freely in Hope, a faith-based nonprofit that aims to end sexual violence within churches. Founded in 2010, the organization has focused on Africa for a decade, but is moving its spotlight to America. We believe that the solutions and experiences we built in Kenya and Zambia can be a catalyst for change for faith leaders in America, explained its founder, Nicole Lim. Freely in Hope launched its new initiative with a conference in San Francisco in mid-June, titled Redeeming Sanctuaries, to provide church leaders with survivor-centered tools and solutions to make churches safer places. The organization's shift to North America was also prompted by the numerous recent sexual abuse scandals in American churches. Last year, a Guidepost Solutions report documented how the Southern Baptist Convention covered up sexual abuses for decades. Lim grew up attending a Salvation Army church in Chinatown, San Francisco. After telling sexual abuse stories as a documentary filmmaker in Eastern and Southern Africa, she wanted to do more to help change survivors' lives. With Freely in Hope, Lim and her team impacted more than 10,000 people, funded 43 high school and university scholarships, and trained 431 leaders on sexual violence prevention. For Lim, the first step to changing the mentality around church sexual abuse is acknowledging abuses do happen. Leaders are afraid to address the issue because of the taboo and shame that is encircle sex in the Christian world, she explained. Yet, one out of three women has been abused in the world, noted Lim, quoting a 2021 WHO report on violence against women. Irene Cho, another survivor invited to speak at the Redeeming Sanctuaries conference, also underlined how a culture of silence in churches has protected sexual abusers for years. At 9 years old, Cho found God in an Assembly of God-esque type of church, she said, where her mom converted a few years before. Later, the family moved to the East Coast, and Cho and her mom attended a Korean Pentecostal church, where her faith really began to grow, she said. At 17, she felt the call to enter the ministry. When she was 18, she said, her senior pastor assaulted her. It took me about a year to share it, she said. Around her, Cho didn't find many people to talk to. She opened up to a college pastor who offered prayers and often checked on her. During this period, she continued to serve in the church and emotionally detached herself from what happened. I perform to perfection, she said. In 2021, Dr. Heather Evans served on the Southern Baptist Convention Sexual Abuse Task Force, which oversaw the investigation revealing the mishandling of sexual abuse cases by the church. She also works with sex trafficking victims in East Africa. Based on her experience in the SBC task force and with clergy sexual abuse survivors, Evans observed that in a church setting, the trauma is physical, social, and spiritual. Gaslighting and denial are common responses to sexual abuse revelations in churches, and they worsen the traumatic symptoms the victim experiences, explained Evans. Contrary to trauma caused by a one-time shock, these victims face a complex, enduring trauma that does damage to their view of themselves, she said. Silencing victims or refusing to offer compassionate listening also aggravates their situation. When you talk to victims, many of them will tell you the abuse was terrible. But what was more damaging is the response, or the lack of response, from those that were supposed to help. It further re-traumatizes them. It further isolates them. It's a further betrayal, she said. For Cho, who is still involved in a church, toxic misogynistic ideologies that permeate churches fuel stigma around sexual abuse. To prevent abuses, churches need to unpack what it actually means when you are catering to patriarchy, when you are catering to purity culture, she said. All of these issues go together. These oppressive systems are all intertwined and influence the church in its ideology, according to Cho. In his church, Eric Hayes observed firsthand how taboos and shame around sex perpetuated abuses. A lot of time, religious people are just uncomfortable talking about anything that's related to sex. In the process, people are being victimized, and their stories aren't told, and we don't listen to them, and we aren't talking about it, because it feels yucky. Since 2022, Hayes has hosted discussions on abuse in his 150-member congregation, the Fremont Community Church in California. Survivors come to share their stories and are offered reflective listening, a technique the young pastor learned from Bobby Jackson, a Chicago-based pastor and counselor, that consists of attentive and quiet listening. Sometimes Hayes meets survivors who have left churches without being heard by anyone. Through these sessions, he hopes to foster changes and inspire other leaders to break the cycle in their churches. We are not going to hide any skeletons. We're going to expose things to the light because that's the only way they can be healed, he said. He also noted that implementing stricter background checks in churches was crucial. I was kind of shocked to learn how many churches don't do that. It's a basic safety measure. I can't volunteer as a baseball coach in my local community without going through background checks. Certainly, as a church, we should be protecting people better than that. Hayes, who is pursuing a Doctor of Ministry degree from Northern Seminary, also hopes seminaries offer more training around sexual abuse to aspiring leaders. He didn't learn about this 20 years ago in college, he said, and has had to make up for his lack of knowledge by himself. In this sense, Freely and Hope visits seminaries and churches to educate aspiring leaders. At the Redeeming Sanctuaries Conference, about 40 church leaders were provided with resources to ensure the safety of their structures, a first step toward more accountability within congregations, explained Lim. Nangwala also stressed how churches need to implement more accountability structures. They are there, but are only known by leadership, never communicated to the congregation, she said. On social media posts, she recently realized her abuser was still serving in the same church, sometimes in pictures with children. While she is not waiting for an apology from her former congregation, the young woman hopes these sessions will force churches to stop burying their heads in the sand and address these issues. I think justice looks like ensuring that churches realize this is a huge problem and it's happening in their church, and make everything to be safe. An article entitled U.S. Mormons Are Becoming Less Republican, But Not by Much, published on June 21 and written by Jana Rice. Earlier this month, leaders of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints issued an unprecedented statement about the dangers of voting a straight party ticket. Merely voting a straight ticket or voting based on tradition without careful study of candidates and their positions on important issues is a threat to democracy and inconsistent with revealed standards, the First Presidency wrote to members in the United States. Since Latter-day Saints, Mormons, in this country have a decades-long history of voting Republican, the tradition church leaders appear to be challenging is the all-too-common default setting of conservative church members, voting for whichever candidate has an R next to their name. What's surprising about this is that half a century ago, it was a church leader who infamously suggested that nothing short of a wholehearted embrace of the GOP would suffice for church members. As then-apostle Ezra Taft Benson controversially stated in 1974, a good Mormon could not be a Democrat. Although Benson was privately rebuked for it by the prophet at that time, Spencer W. Kimball, the damage was done. Many older U.S. Mormons still assume that GOP stands for God's Own Party. But the reality is that Mormons in America have become less Republican over time. However, it's less of a blue wave than it is a blue ripple. Drawing from Cooperative Election Study national data from 2008 to 2022, sociologist Ryan Burge has created a graph of Mormon partisan affiliation over time. Note, each party's numbers include some leaners who identify as independent, but say they lean more toward one party or the other. There is a range of Republican affiliation from the high water mark of 75% GOP affiliation in 2012 to the nadir, which was 53% in both 2017 and 2021. One thing to keep in mind with this data is that odd-numbered years in the CES survey have a much smaller sample size. So the total number of LDS respondents in 2017 and 2019, 273 and 293 respectively, is less than half what it can be in election years, e.g., 870 Mormons in 2016 and 764 in 2020. This means that results from even-numbered years are somewhat more reliable. To offer a more user-friendly perspective, I compiled the CES data into 3 5-year blocks, averaging the LDS respondents' political affiliation from 2008 to 2012, 2013 to 2017, and 2018 to 2022. This approach creates comparison groups with larger sample sizes, smoothing out some of the year-to-year fluctuations that are more likely with the small sample sizes in individual surveys. My chart compares the first and last blocks of years, comparing the 2008 to 2012 period to partisan affiliation 10 years later. The main takeaway is that there have been modest GOP losses of about 7 points overall. However, this hasn't been a slam dunk for the Democratic Party. Democrats appear to have gained only 3 points, while independents gained 4. The major losses for LDS Republicans have come among the younger generations. An additional graph that Burge created of the even year CS data is broken into 7 different cohorts by birth decade. What we see across the board is that each cohort's level of Republican and Republican-leaning identity takes a hit in 2016 compared with 2008, and especially compared with 2012, when Romney was the GOP presidential nominee. But for older Mormons, Republican identity bounces back, so any Trump disaffection appears to be a temporary blip. Not so for the generations born in the 1980s and later, whose GOP affiliation took that same hit in 2016, but then kept on declining. So if there's a silver lining for Mormon Democrats, it's that younger people appear to be turning away from the Republican Party in a more enduring fashion, at least up to now. The CES data resonates with recent generational findings from the 2022 Wave 2 of the Next Mormon Survey, which Benjamin Knoll and I are currently analyzing. When we first conducted Wave 1 of the Next Mormon Survey back in 2016, we noted a stronger preference for the GOP among older U.S. Latter-day Saints. That was still true in 2022 as well, with a full 93% of silent generation respondents embracing the Republican cause. Not one of the survey's 49 silent generation respondents identified as a Democrat. That's a small sample size from which to draw conclusions, but the finding tracks with previous research about older Mormons' political conservatism. The silent generation, born through 1945, were adults in the Ezra Taft Benson era, when LDS political conservatism had become a given. We also see strong GOP identification among the 229 baby boomers in the NMS2, born 1946 to 1964, 80% of whom identified as Republicans. It's between baby boomers and Generation X that we see the largest drop. The GOP is 53% of Gen X, 54% of millennials, and 48% of the youngest respondents, Gen Z. But again, this isn't a wave, but a ripple. In the second Next Mormon survey, we see the Democratic Party also bleeding a bit amongst its younger LDS adherents, with about 3 in 10 Gen Xers and millennials, but only 1 in 5 among Gen Z. In fact, there is many people in Gen Z who say they have no political preference as report being Democrats. It will be interesting to see whether the church's statement against straight party voting does anything to soften older saints' apparent sense that to be a faithful Mormon means to fully align with the Republican Party. Frankly, I doubt it. The last several years have brought us an abundance of social science research indicating that many Americans' political identities have become more powerful to them than even their religious identities. But among younger U.S. church members, the GOP's lock seems to already be weakening. Now, an article published on June 22 in the Religion News Service and written by David I. Klein, entitled, "In Church Remains, German Archaeologists Discover the Truth of Atlantis of the North Sea." Once upon a time, in the marshes of the Wadden Sea, which spans the western coast of Denmark, Germany, and parts of the Netherlands, a great center of trade and commerce arose. Known as Rungholt, the city grew rich off the region's abundant amber, salt, and whales, and became an essential stop for North Sea traders. However, as often follows money and power, its people grew vain and arrogant. When they first built dikes to keep the great sea at bay, they shouted back, "Defy us if you have the courage, Blanke Hans," using a local nickname for a rough and wild sea, White Hans. One Christmas morning in the 14th century, its town people decided to defy God himself, like the biblical builders of the Tower of Babel before them. A group of young men tried to make a mockery of the church by tricking a priest into giving last rites to a pig disguised as a man. When the priest refused, They beat him senseless. Barely escaping with his life, the priest prayed that the men would be punished. God answered him with a vision, "Leave the island at once." Shortly thereafter, Blanca Hans found its courage. The winds roared, the waves raged, and Rungholt was wiped from the face of the earth. All its thousands of inhabitants died. It was a great drowning of men. At least, that's the legend, which proliferated in church sermons, chronicles, and art across the region of Frisia for 6 centuries. A parable about the vice of arrogance and the dangers of wealth and prosperity. As a mythic lost city, it would sometimes be called the Atlantis of the North Sea. The reality of Rungholt is something different. A group of German archaeologists announced last month, after discovering what they believe to have been the central church of the medieval settlement. Archaeologist Ruth Blankenfeldt, a member of the Rungholt Project, a collective of archaeologists who have been researching the area for years, pointed out that the remains indicate a structure large enough to have been the center of a parish, and thus likely Rungholt. The finds thus joins the ranks of the large churches of North Frisia. Bent Sven Majazak, an archaeologist at Kiel University in Germany, who also is a member of the Rungholt Project, said in a statement. Still, the researchers cautioned against taking much of the legend as truth. For one, even calling Rungholt a city is a stretch. It's not a city as you might think, with streets and houses. It's a dwelling mound around dikes in the outlands. Ulf Eicherot, another member of the Rungholt Project, told Religion News Service. Dwelling mounds, or terps, provided living spaces above the height regularly flooded by changing tides. The earthworks, though common in the area, were no minor feat of engineering in their time. What is historical, however, is the calamity that destroyed the city. The great drowning of men, a massive storm surge in 1362, which caused flooding around the North Sea and killed as many as 25,000 in what is today the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, Germany, and Denmark. The great drowning of men really had a huge impact, changing the area, the areas that were settled into ones that were no longer inhabitable, Eicherot said. The destruction of dike zones was quite common in the Wadden Sea area, but not in this amount. That's something that hangs in the collective memory. And 3 centuries later, a Lutheran priest, Anton Hemrick, inscribed the story into his North Frisian Chronicle, the oldest extant record of the legend. The Protestant priest uses Rungholt as a motif of transience or impermanence, meaning be good, otherwise punishment will follow, Eicherot said. This is a religious motif that was combined with collective knowledge that there was a village or city or some formation that had been destroyed. Another 2 centuries after Heinrich, the German poet Detlev von Lillenkron further immortalized Rungholt's tale in his ballad Trutz, Blanca Hans. Today I traveled over Rungholt. The city went under 600 years ago, begins the poem. The waves are still beating wildly and indignantly as when they destroyed the marshes. Lillenkron's telling casts the legend as a warning, less about man's arrogance and defiance of God, but that of nature. Comparing Rungholt to Rome and painting Blanca Hans, i.e., the unpredictable nature of the seas, as a monster whose body stretches from the shores of England to the sands of Brazil. By Lillenkron's time, Rungholt was seen as something primarily of myth, but changing tides in the Wadden Sea in the 1920s began to reveal evidence that there had been a medieval settlement there. And for more than a century, archaeologists have tried to pin down the exact location of the legendary town. The search for the Church of Rungholt was always a focus and often discussed, Maja Zak said. According to Vice, a main question was always the character of Rungholt as such. Was it a town, even a city, or just a regular but possibly important village in the marshes? The descriptions of both Lilienkron and Heimrich exaggerate Rungholt far beyond anything the archaeologists have found evidence for. But they illustrate how settlements and natural disasters can remain in the collective consciousness centuries on. Rungholt is a prominent example of the effects of massive human intervention in the northern German coastal region that continue to this day, the archaeologist statement said. In addition to the mound where the church was found, some 54 similar mounds remain yet to be investigated. And now an excerpt from an article published on June 25 entitled Unitarian Universalist Elect First Woman of Color, Openly Queer President by Catherine Post. A woman theologian, ethicist, and minister was installed as the 10th president of the Unitarian Universalist Association on June 25, following an uncontested election in which she secured 95.5% of the vote. She is both the first openly queer person and first woman of color to lead the faith tradition and will serve a 6-year term. The child of parents from Panama and Chile, the Reverend Sophia Bentoncourt, has been a national leader in the UUA for more than 2 decades. Though her predecessor, the Reverend Susan Frederick Gray, was the first woman to hold the title, in 2017, she was tapped to become interim co-president of the UUA when the Reverend Peter Morales resigned amid controversy over racial disparities in the UUA hiring practices. "I am thrilled for the theological depth that she will bring," Frederick Gray told Religion News Service. "I think she will bring a depth of moral clarity and a pastoral presence that is still so needed in our world." We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available at our podcast, as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.